The conference began on a rainy morning during the last week of March 1923. I was obliged, during the course of that first morning, to go constantly in and out of the room, and so was unable to follow the proceedings at all fully. But I recall Lord Darlington opening the discussions by formally welcoming the guests before going on to outline the strong moral case for a relaxing of various aspects of the Versailles Treaty, emphasizing the great suffering he had himself witnessed in Germany. Monsieur Dupont, so far as I could observe, was not contributing to the discussions, and it was hard to tell from his sullen demeanour if he was attending carefully to what was being said, or else deeply engrossed in other thoughts. At one stage, when I happened to depart the room in the midst of an address by one of the German gentlemen, Monsieur Dupont suddenly rose and followed me out. "Butler," he said, once we were in the hall, "I wonder if I could have my feet changed. They are giving me so much discomfort now, I can hardly listen to these gentlemen." As I recall, I had conveyed a plea to Miss Kenton for assistance, and had left Monsieur Dupont sitting in the billiard room awaiting his nurse, when the first footman had come hurrying down the staircase, in some distress, to inform me that my father had been taken ill upstairs. I hurried up to the first floor, and on turning at the landing was met by a strange sight. At the far end of the corridor, my father's figure could be seen frozen in a posture that suggested he was taking part in some ceremonial ritual. He had dropped down onto one knee, and with head bowed, seemed to be pushing at the trolley before him, which for some reason had taken on an obstinate immobility. I went to my father and eased him down onto the carpet. His eyes were closed, his face was an ashen colour, and there were beads of sweat on his forehead. Once my father had been laid in his bed, I was a little uncertain as to how to proceed, for whilst it seemed undesirable that I leave my father in such a condition, I did not really have a moment more to spare. As I stood hesitating in the doorway, Miss Kenton appeared at my side and said, "Mr. Stevens, I have a little more time than you at the moment. I shall, if you wish, attend to your father. I shall show Dr. Meredith up and notify you if he has anything noteworthy to say." "Thank you, Miss Kenton," I said, and took my leave. When I returned to the drawing-room, I immediately found myself more than occupied replenishing the guests with tea and coffee. I was, I recall, leaving the drawing-room with an empty teapot in my hand when Miss Kenton stopped me and said, "Mr. Stevens, Dr. Meredith is just leaving now." I went to him, the teapot still in my hand. "Your father's not so good," he said. "If he deteriorates, call me again immediately." I thanked the doctor and showed him out. It was that evening, shortly before dinner, that I overheard the conversation between Mr. Lewis and Monsieur Dupont. I had gone up to Monsieur Dupont's room and was about to knock, but before doing so, I paused for a second to listen at the door. "You may not yourself be in the habit of taking this small precaution to avoid knocking at some highly inappropriate moment, but I can vouch that it is common practice amongst many professionals. However, when I put my ear to Monsieur Dupont's door, I happened to hear Mr. Lewis's voice, and though I cannot recall precisely the actual words, it was the tone of his voice that raised my suspicions. It is hard for me now to recall precisely what I overheard, just as it was for me later that same evening when I reported to his lordship on the matter. In effect, the American gentleman was putting forward the view that Monsieur Dupont was being manipulated by his lordship and other participants at the conference. I'm not sure now if I ever proceeded to knock. In any case, I did not linger long enough to hear anything that would give a clue as to Monsieur Dupont's attitude to Mr. Lewis's remarks. In the meantime, my father's condition had grown neither better nor worse. As I understood, he was asleep for much of the time. I did not have a chance actually to converse with him until that second evening after the return of his illness. On that occasion, too, my father was sleeping when I entered, but the chambermaid Miss Kenton had left in attendance stood up upon seeing me and began to shake my father's shoulder. "Mr. Stevens said to wake him if you return, sir." My father opened his eyes, turned his head a little on the pillow, and looked at me. "I hope father is feeling better now," I said. He went on gazing at me for a moment, then asked,
"Everything in hand downstairs?"
"Yes, I dare say you can rest assured on that. I'm very glad father is feeling better." With some deliberation, he withdrew his arms from under the bedclothes and gazed tiredly at the backs of his hands. Then he said slowly,
"I'm proud of you. A good son. I hope I've been a good father to you. I suppose I haven't. I'm afraid we're extremely busy now, but we can talk again in the morning." My father was still looking at his hands, as though he were faintly irritated by them.
"I'm so glad you're feeling better now," I said again, and took my leave. On that second and final dinner of the conference, the company had lost much of the reserve that had been noticeable throughout the previous days. At the close of dinner, his lordship rose to address his guests. Now, it should be said, perhaps, that Lord Darlington was never what might be called a natural public speaker, and soon little sounds of restlessness grew steadily around the room. Indeed, by the time Lord Darlington had finally come round to bidding his guests rise and drink to peace and justice in Europe, the level of such noises struck me as bordering on the ill-mannered. The company had seated themselves again when there came an authoritative rapping of knuckles upon wood, and Monsieur Dupont had risen to his feet. At once a hush fell over the room. The distinguished gentleman glanced around with a look almost of severity. Then he said, "Many things of interest have been said in this house over the past days. Let me say now that I have been impressed by certain of the arguments I have heard here. I am happy to assure you that I will bring what modest influence I have to encourage certain changes of emphasis in French policy in accordance with much of what has been said here." There was a ripple of applause. Monsieur Dupont held up his hand. "But before I go on to thank our host, Lord Darlington, I have some small things I would wish to remove from my chest. My only question concerning Mr. Lewis is this. To what extent does his abominable behavior exemplify the attitude of the present American administration? I have, over the last 6 months, had occasion to discuss this matter with a number of very highly placed Americans. All those of us who care for the future well-being of Europe will take comfort from the fact that Mr. Lewis is now hardly the influence he once was. Perhaps you think me unduly harsh to express these things so openly, but the reality is, I am being merciful. I refrain from outlining just what this gentleman has been saying to me about you all. But enough of condemnations. Join me, please, ladies and gentlemen, in raising your glasses to Lord Darlington." An uneasy silence reigned for a moment, and then finally Mr. Lewis rose to his feet. He was smiling pleasantly in his customary manner. "Well, since everyone's giving speeches, I may as well take a turn," he said. "As it happens, I do have something to say. Now, you gentlemen, forgive me, but you are just a bunch of naive dreamers. Now, let's take our good host here. What is he? He is a classic English gentleman, decent, honest, well-meaning. But his lordship is an amateur. And international affairs today are no longer for gentlemen amateurs. You need professionals to run your affairs. And if you don't realize that soon, you're headed for disaster. A toast, gentlemen, to professionalism." Almost immediately, Lord Darlington stood up.
"I have no wish," his lordship said, "to enter into a quarrel on this our last evening together. But let me say this. What you describe as amateurism, sir, is what I think most of us here still prefer to call honour."
It was just around this stage that I became aware of the first footman beside me, who whispered, "Miss Kenton would like a word with you, sir." Miss Kenton looked rather upset. "Your father has become very ill, Mr. Stevens," she said. "I've called for Dr. Meredith, but he may be a little delayed."
I must have looked confused, for Miss Kenton then said, "Mr. Stevens, he really is in a poor state. You had better come and see him." "But the gentlemen are liable to retire to the smoking room at any moment."
"Of course, but you must come now, Mr. Stevens, or else you may deeply regret it later." My father's face had gone a dull reddish colour, like no colour I had seen on a living being. I heard Miss Kenton say softly behind me, "His pulse is very weak." I gazed at my father for a moment, touched his forehead slightly, then withdrew my hand. I turned away and said to Miss Kenton,
This is most distressing. Nevertheless, I must now return downstairs.
I will tell you when the doctor arrives, or else when there are any changes.
I hurried down the stairs and was in time to see the gentleman proceeding into the smoking room. Whatever had taken place in the banqueting hall after my departure, there was now a genuine celebratory atmosphere amongst the guests. I felt something touch my elbow and turned to find Lord Darlington.
Stevens, are you all right? You look as though you're crying.
I laughed and, taking out a handkerchief, quickly wiped my face. I'm very sorry, sir. These strains of a hard day. Someone addressed his lordship and he turned away to reply. I caught sight of Miss Kenton through the open doorway signalling to me. I began to make my way towards the doors, but before I could reach them, Monsieur Dupont touched my arm. Butler, he said, I wonder if you would find me some fresh bandages. My feet are unbearable again.
Yes, sir.
As I proceeded towards the doors, I realized Monsieur Dupont was following me. I turned and said, I will come and find you, sir, just as soon as I have what is required. Miss Kenton was standing out in the hall. She said,
Mr. Stevens, I'm very sorry. Your father passed away about 4 minutes ago.
I see.
She looked at her hands, then up at my face. Mr. Stevens, I'm very sorry. I wish there was something I could say. Will you come up and see him?
I'm very busy just now, Miss Kenton. In a little while, perhaps. Please don't think me unduly improper in not attending to see my father in his deceased condition just at this moment. You see, I know my father would have wished me to carry on just now. I turned away and re-entered the smoking room. Monsieur Dupont tapped my shoulder and said, Butler, have you seen to my arrangements? As it happens, sir, a doctor is on his way.
Ah, very good.
Monsieur Dupont resumed his conversation, and I continued my way around the room for some moments. Just then a footman emerged behind me. Miss Kenton is wishing to have a word with you, sir, he said. On this occasion, Monsieur Dupont followed me out of the door. Miss Kenton was once more standing out in the hall.
Mr. Stevens, she said, Dr. Meredith has arrived and gone upstairs.
Monsieur Dupont behind me exclaimed immediately, Ah, good! I led him into the billiard room, where I stoked the fire while he sat down in one of the leather-arm chairs and began to remove his shoes.
Thank you, Butler. You've done well.
Miss Kenton was still waiting for me in the hallway, and we ascended through the house in silence. Up in my father's room, Dr. Meredith rose and said, My condolences, Stevens. He suffered a severe stroke. There was nothing in the world you could have done to save him. I'll be on my way now.
You'll see to arrangements?
Yes, sir. However, if I may, there is a most distinguished gentleman downstairs in need of your attention. I led Dr. Meredith downstairs, showed him into the billiard room, then returned quickly to the smoking room, where the atmosphere, if anything, had grown even more convivial. Of course, it is not for me to suggest that I am worthy of ever being placed alongside the likes of the great butlers of our generation. Even so, you may not think I delude myself unduly if I go so far as to suggest that I did perhaps display, at least in some modest degree, a dignity worthy of someone like my father. For all its sad associations, whenever I recall that evening today, I find I do so with a large sense of triumph.